We're going to look at the Agadata of what most people know to be the story of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai in the cave. Although, we're going to look at the context of the story, because a lot of people know about the cave part, but not everybody necessarily remembers or realizes that there's a whole preamble to the story, and there's also a postscript or a post-narrative that takes place after the story when he comes out of the cave. Although this might be something we would learn around the time of Lag BaOmer, I think there are a lot of good reasons to talk about it now, post-Chanukah, and next week there's a fast day, Sarah B'Tevet. Talk a little bit about the cultures that are around us, and that's really how the story begins. I want to actually start, everybody knows there was a very tragic terrorist attack this week, and there's a few names that I want to just mention. Hebrew names we'll learn in their merit for Fuash Lema, Shiria El, Adlior Sara, Rach Hanolad, Ben Shiria El, Amichai Yishai Ben Fega Gittel Kalila, Betoch Sharchal Yisrael. If there are other people you want to have in mind for Fuash Lema, you can mention them as well, and we'll learn in their Zechut. So one of the sort of ways to enter this topic, to enter this discussion, is by way of thinking about Chanukah that we just passed us as a Chag. And that is to say that we spoke a lot about what's the miracle of Chanukah, and what are we celebrating, and what are we thinking about, and what are we excited about on the Chag, religiously, as a nation, as a people. And We talk about the oil, we talk about the war, but there's also the spiritual victory, or the victory against assimilation, cultural assimilation. You can wonder to yourself, we live in Israel, here in Israel, live in Israel, studying in Israel, and we're in a country that has a lot of other cultures, yet we hear about a statistic in Israel that's a very, very, very low assimilation and intermarriage rate in Israel, very low. In other words, cultural assimilation, obviously, we're all assimilated to some extent because we live in a westernized world, and we'll talk a little bit about that as well. But Jewishly, this is a Jewish country, it's a Jewish state. As we said, Hanukkah is a very culturally kept holiday. Pretty much everybody in the country lights a menorah or does some sort of celebration of Hanukkah on some level or another, no matter how religious or irreligious one is. You don't really feel outside sort of influences in the country that much, unless you go to, Christian Quarter or, Nazareth or one of these cities that has other cultures living there, celebrating other kinds of holidays. But you won't really see it here in the country. And the question is sort of what happens in Jewish history when there's a culture that is dominant or is attractive, is giving the Jews a reason to feel, wow, this is something that I want to, or sort of a feeling of our culture is inferior and that culture is superior and I want to take on that culture. And we know what happens when that takes place in history. That's when the Jews assimilate, right? When the Jews don't feel that what they have is superior, what they have is significant, is valuable, is important, they will jump and join a different culture and assimilate another culture. And that's exactly what happened during the years of the story of Chanukah, the years preceding it, as we spoke about Hellenization, the whole Greek philosophy, the Syrian Greek Empire. That was a dominant culture, and the battle of the Chashmonaim was not just against a physical enemy, it was really against the elites of the Jewish community that had taken on these cultures, right? It's taken on these wisdoms, these philosophies. And that was a very courageous battle to fight. You're fighting against your own people who have assimilated into another way of thinking. Similar story happened in the time of Purim, right? What does it say? The reason why the Jews were punished, one of the reasons given in the Gemara, is because they were participating in the meal, right, with Achashverosh at his palace, at his palace grounds in Shushan. And you think about that and you say to yourself, that's interesting that today, if you live in Israel, There isn't really that much assimilation. It's 0.0001% of the population actually assimilates, you know, leaves Judaism altogether. Are people secular in the country? Of course. But the people assimilate completely into another way of thinking? Not really. But if you live in America, if you live in Europe, if you live in other countries, assimilation is very high. And that often comes as a result of people feeling that what they have is inferior to something that's outside of them. So I want to sort of open up with that. It's provocative, right, to think about this question. And this text, this Agadah that we're going to study, really addresses this head on and raises a lot of these kinds of questions that I think many of us struggle with, and many of us will struggle with in the future, probably not as much when you're sort of immersed in a world of Torah and Judaism and learning here in seminary and school in Israel, but is something that very much is important to consider and think about and develop as a perspective as you begin, we're not near the end of the year, but as you begin to sort of think about the future of your life and professional and wherever you see yourself, it's something to consider. Okay, all of that is introduction. Let's jump in. Let's get a few people reading here. we'll go through the story together. And who'd like to begin? You can read it in the Hebrew or in the Gemara or in the English. It says, I broke it into parts. So it's we can look at each section as sort of scenes of the story. Who'd like to begin for us? Go ahead.
When our sages...
Yeah, when our sages entered the vineyard in Yavne.
When our sages entered the vineyard in Yavne, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yehuda, son of Rabbi
Elai,
who was the head of the speakers in every place, responded. In this breitah, Rabbi Yehuda is described as head of the speakers in every place. The Gemara asks, and why did they call him head of the speakers in every place? The Gemara relates that this resulted due to an incident that took place when Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon were sitting, and Yehuda's son of converts sat beside them. Rabbi Yehuda opened and said, how pleasant are the actions of this nation. The Romans, as they established marketplaces, established bridges, and established baths. Rabbi Yossi was silent. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochanan responded and said, everything that they established only for their own purposes. They established marketplaces to place prostitutes in them, bathhouses to pamper themselves, and bridges to collect taxes from all who pass over them. Yehuda, son of converts, went and related their statements to his household, and those statements continued to spread until they were heard by the monarchy. They ruled and said, Yehuda, who elevated the Roman regime, shall be elevated and appointed as head of the city. The head of the speakers in every place. Yossi, who remained silent, shall be exiled from his home in Judea as punishment, and sent to the city of Tzipori in the Galilee. And Shimon, who denounced the government, shall be killed.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have an introduction to our story. So let's just unpack this for a minute, and then we'll continue. We can raise some questions. We're going to come back to look at the whole story in one discussion at the end. We have a debate, essentially a debate. Let's just, first of all, give the historical setting. Yavne is in the country, you know, north, south, middle. Anybody ever heard of Yavne? Is it yeshiva? Karen B. Yavne. What was that?
Middle.
It's a little bit more north. It's a little bit more north. It's actually probably not too far from here if you look at a map. More center of the country. Center north. And not north, but you know, like Netanya north. I don't know if you guys consider yourself north. Anyway, you don't want to believe that you're in the north. It's not such a bad thing. The north is beautiful. Beautiful part of the country. So the setting is Yavne. What's Yavne? Why Yavne? Why are they there? Why are the rabbis gathering in Yavne and not in Jerusalem, which is where the Sanhedrin usually is? This must mean that we're talking about a later time after the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash. So historical setting. We know that because they're talking about the Romans. Romans are... After the Greeks, And the Romans are the ones who destroyed the second Beit HaMikdash. So we're talking about post-temple, there's no Sanhedrin anymore in Jerusalem. The rabbinic community has now moved from Jerusalem to a place called Yavne. Maybe you remember the story of the destruction of Jerusalem, and there was a rabbi, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who went to the Caesar and said, at least let us have, you know, a place for the Jewish people to restart their community, restart their scholarship. And that was the request. You can have Jerusalem, but let us have the city of Yavne. So the rabbinic community and the Jewish community sort of centralized around this place called Yavne. And that's where Jewish life began to be reestablished after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Now you have these giants of Jewish history. Rabbi Shimon here is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi. These are some of the most significant players in the text of Jewish history and the history of rebuilding, of sort of saving what was left of the Jewish people. And they have a major debate about how to assimilate or not assimilate the culture that was around them. And again, it should be made clear, the Romans didn't invent bathhouses, the Romans didn't invent bridges, and the Romans didn't invent marketplaces. These had been around for a very long time before them. The question that was on the table was the Roman version of these innovations, the Roman version of these societal institutions that are there to benefit people. How should we react? So there are three sort of approaches, right? There's the approach of, let's call it, if you can't beat them, join them. Rabbi Yehuda, who sort of says, we have to see the good, we have to try to take what we can from those cultures and join society and figure out a way to do it in a kosher way, do it in a way that works for us. Then you have the middle ground, which is Rabbi Yossi, who is silent. We'll have to unpack what that means. So think a little bit about how is silence an opinion? If a person is silent, does that even mean they're giving an opinion? If a person is silent, does it mean they agree or disagree or both, perhaps? What does silence represent? One sec, and then I'll take your answer. And the third approach, which was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, is the opposite extreme. He's fire and brimstone against anything that the Romans bring into society. Because even if you think it's good, it's coming from a place of evil, of corruption, of prostitution, of self-serving, of trying to corrupt others, and we shouldn't give credence, we shouldn't buy in, we shouldn't assimilate, we shouldn't join, we should just reject and push away and destroy and get rid of completely. So that's a debate. Now, what happens as a result of this debate? And then I'll take your comments and questions. What happens as a result of this debate? There is a tattletale. I'm going to put it in quotations because it's a little bit complicated what the role of this person, Yehuda ben Gerim, Yehuda's son of converts, he goes and he tells the Roman officials. And they react differently for each individual. Rabbi Yehuda, they give him this new status. That's, Penina, how the story began. Rabbi Yehuda gets this new status called Rosh HaMidabrim. Rosh HaMidabrim Makom Makom, the head of the speakers. How would you define the role of head of the speakers? Some like political position. He's given status in society. Remember, the Romans are in charge. So if you have a title, president of the community, right, Nasi, for example, Rosh HaMidabrim is some kind of political status, powerful position. And Rabbi Yehuda was given that position because he spoke nicely about the Romans. Rabbi Yossi, he was kind of exiled. He wasn't punished. Sort of a punishment, but sort of a compromise. We're not going to let you live where you live. We're going to take you out of that community and put you somewhere else. What does that mean? Why is he being moved from place to place? Question for later. And lastly, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, he's going to be executed because he spoke out negatively against the Roman, the ruling Roman monarchy or empire that was in charge of the Jewish community. Okay, comments and questions. You were going to say something about silence or something else.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead.
When you learn from like our owners, and you're silent and you just agree.
Yeah, so one way of looking at this is silence, when it comes after somebody else says something, right? And silence is acquiescence. You have that saying. You also have, in Hebrew, it's shtika kohoda'a, which is actually kind of a halachic. It's like if I say, you owe me $100 and then you don't respond, you're just silent. So there's a sort of a halachic concept, a question that's brought up. Maybe your silence is that you agree that you actually do owe me, even if you don't say yes. Because by not denying it, you're agreeing to it. That's one perspective on silence. Are there any other ways to look at this? Can silence be defined as something else other than just agreement? Yeah.
It could also be just not being invited.
Not willing to... Okay, so you're saying, just if I hear you correctly, is that neutrality? I'm neutral?
No, I don't. Like, you could disagree, but...
I don't want to get in an argument.
If somebody says right,
I'd rather not say anything because I don't want to get in trouble. I don't want to. It's not going to help. Perhaps it's not going to help if I say something. It's not going to change the reality. Maybe. But the trouble with this perspective is it's hard to call that. Not that you said this, but in general, it's hard to say that if a person's silent just because they don't want to get in a fight. I don't know if that's really in the middle. I don't know if we could really call that a middle position. I'm not saying that you said that. I'm just saying, in general, when you have these types of things in society or in history, when there's something, when there's an injustice going on and someone is silent because they don't want to get involved, I don't think that that's called neutrality. Not that that's what you said, but that is a sort of a question that comes up. Another way to think about silence is to say that it reveals an inner conflict. There are compelling reasons to agree, there are compelling reasons to disagree, and it's very hard to promote one side over the other. Even to the extent, and I would say this, and this is probably what's actually going on in the story, it's, on the one hand, you want to preserve a certain ideal, that the Jewish community is to remain idealistic, and connected to Hashem, and connected to just holy things, and we shouldn't assimilate at all. That's one side. But then we also live in the world, on the other hand, and it's hard to figure out how to do that in the right way. So, because, I wouldn't call it a non-decision, but it's a conflict. It's complexity. Life is complex. Living in the modern world is complex. Or living in ancient society is complex, because you're not living in your own culture. You're living among other cultures as well. Okay, so that's sort of an introduction. So now Rabbi Shimon is going to be on the run. Who wants to read the next part of the story? Go ahead. Bottom of the first page.
Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his son, Rabbi Elazar, went and hid in the study hut. Every day Rabbi Shimon's wife would bring them bread and a jug of water, and they would eat. When the decree intensified, Rabbi Shimon said to his son, "Women are easily impressionable, and therefore there is room for concern, lest the authorities torture her and she reveal our whereabouts." They went and they hid in a cave. A miracle occurred and a carob tree was created for them, as well as a spring of water. They would remove their clothes and sit covered in sand up to their necks. They would study Torah all day in that manner. At the time of prayer, they would dress, cover themselves, and pray, and they would again remove their clothes afterwards so that they would not become tattered. They sat in the cave for 12 years. Elijah the prophet came and stood at the entrance of the cave and said, "Who will inform Bar Yochai that the emperor died and that his decree has been answered?"
Okay, so this is part of the story maybe you've heard before. What's going on in this part of the story? Yeah.
No, I just have a question.
Go ahead.
Why would she give up where her kid and
husband? Why would she
give up where her kid and husband?
She wouldn't. Out of out of regular, and she's hiding this fact. But when pressured to, they were afraid she may, pardon?
It's her kid.
And her husband, right? They were worried. They didn't want it to get to a scenario where she would be pressured and forced to give up this information. So they sort of preempted that by running away further, by hiding further. What do people make of this, I would call it, disengagement from the world? Okay, they're starting in regular society, then they move into the Beit Midrash. What does the Beit Midrash represent? To you, what does the Beit Midrash represent in your lives? Now that you've spent some time, you know, spending hours in the Beit Midrash each day. It represents Torah. It represents, what else does it represent? What's the symbol of the Beit Midrash or the feeling of the Beit Midrash? What do you guys think? It's a sort of safe haven of sorts. In other words, that when you're in the Beit Midrash, there are walls around you. There's a division between you and the world that's outside of you.
That's everywhere.
Is it everywhere?
In our houses.
A room that's just Torah. Your houses might have other things in them, other influences in them. You're not wrong. There are walls around your house, and there's a certain division between your house and the outside world, and that's, you know, sort of one of the things we spoke about on Hanukkah, putting your menorah and shining the light of your house out into the world. That's also true. But your house is already different than the Beit Midrash. It already has other things that are influencing what goes on in that house. But a Beit Midrash has this sort of holy environment, a kedusha, a sanctity.
A shul would have that also.
A shul would have that as well, right? Shul would have that as well. Beit Midrash, Beit Knesset. And then there's a disengagement from the world when you go into the Beit Midrash. But this is critical. This is important. Rav Kook says in one place, you know, there's the halacha in a shul. Think about your homes, your synagogues, your shuls where you attend at home, wherever your home is. And think about the fact that in all of your shuls, there are windows in the main shul, the main sanctuary. Now, those windows are probably there because they are good, you know, for natural light and other reasons as well. But there is a halakha. There is a halakha that every shul is meant to have windows. Some say 12 windows. That's more based on, you know, maybe Kabbalistic, 12 tribes, etc. But the idea is every shul is supposed to have windows in the shul. And what's the reason for the windows? Spiritually speaking, what's the reason for the windows? So Rav Kook writes this point, it's a very beautiful idea, that the goal of the window is to remind you that even when you're in the middle of your tefillah, which is this really lofty, elevated spiritual experience, you shouldn't forget that it can't be disconnected from what's going on outside of that room. That there's a world outside of there, and that we are meant to somehow bridge what we're experiencing spiritually and in our religious lives with what happens and what takes place outside of that world. That's the idea of the windows, right? Now, the Beit Midrash is similar to that. So Rabbi Shimon and his son are disengaging. They're leaving sort of the world of the of Roman, you know, the Roman street in Israel, wherever they were, and they're retreating into the Beit Midrash. And well, how else do we see that they're retreating? There are other physical comforts that they retreat in.
They're going into the sand every day.
Before they go into the cave, just in the Beit Midrash, what are they eating? Bread and water. So they're already starting to remove certain pleasures from their diet. There's a significance to this. The more you remove yourself from the world, the physical world, the more of a potentially spiritual experience you will be able to have. Now, we'll talk in a minute whether this is ideal, whether this is not ideal, but let's take it one step further. Then what happens? They realize this isn't going to stay. We can't stay in this place. We can't sustain this type of life. It's too dangerous. We have to retreat once more. And they retreat once more into a cave. The acclaimed cave, they say, is somewhere in the north of Israel, a place called Piki'in. I don't know if anybody's ever been there. Piki'in is a very interesting town, sort of town in Israel, north of Israel. Piki'in is claimed to be the longest standing, what's the word I'm looking for? No break of Jewish settlement in the town, the only one in Israel since the time of, a very long time ago. Thousands of years, you know, that kind of thing. There is no other place in Israel which claims this. Piki'in is the only place that claims this. They have, you know, documentation of the community and who was there, and there's been a constant stream of Jewish residents living in that town. And this is where they say, you can go and visit the site, where they say this is the cave where he was. Whether it's true or it's not true, we don't know from the story where he went. We know he went into a cave, and they were burying himself in sand every day. What was the purpose of doing that? What was the purpose of burying themselves in sand? It says in the story. To preserve their clothing, exactly. So now someone make a call the chomer or a comparison for me. Roman culture, street, Beit Midrash, cave. If the Beit Midrash is already a retreat from normal life and from normal society, so then what is the cave? Yeah, they're completely cut off. When they're in the Beit Midrash, at least they have contact with people who are in the Beit Midrash. They have a little bit of contact with the outside world, right? Rabbi Shimon's wife was coming. She knew that they were there. So they have some contact with the outside world. They have some contact with even the people in the Beit Midrash. But here they retreat into the cave. They're completely, completely cut off from society. From, you know, the physical world, in a sense. And the cave also represents a further removal of physical things. What are they eating in the cave? Basically nothing. They have this carob tree and some water. And that's it. It's really, really, really moving themselves away. And even the whole idea of taking off their clothes also speaks to this idea. Sitting in the sand without clothing on, right? They're just completely... Now they're there for 12 years. What are they doing for 12 years in the cave? What do you imagine that they're doing for 12 years in the cave? It tells us a little bit of what they did. You know, they would put the clothes on to pray, but what were they doing in between Shacharit and Mincha?
Learning.
What were they learning? What kind of Torah do you think they were learning in the cave?
The Zohar.
The Zohar, where do you get that from? There is such a tradition, that's one of the traditions, that during this time that they were in the cave, the Zohar was published, was created, was written. Now, there is actually a comment, I think, from the Alter Rebbe, the first Babich Rebbe, who says that it only actually took them a couple months to write the Zohar. Sounds like a joke. The Zohar is like a very large text in terms of number of words, and it's Kabbalah. Like, it's very deep stuff. You know, the fact that they only took them, like, I think he says they were learning halakha the whole time, and in the last 6 months, they wrote the Zohar. Some comment like that. Okay, whether it's true or not, I wasn't there. Hard to know exactly. But they were doing some type of continuous Torah, you know, experience, continuous spiritual connecting with God. Now, what do you imagine is going to happen in the next part of the story when they are told that the people who are chasing you are no longer chasing you, and you can leave the cave and you can go re-engage, be part of the world again? What do you think is going to happen? They're not going to... They're not going to want to, A. What else? What else is likely to happen? In terms of, you know, where are they? If this is, you know, the world, this is the physical world, where are they? They're above the world. They're not like, they're not part of the world anymore. And they haven't been part of the world for a long time. They haven't interacted with people, with humans, just with each other. They haven't interacted with even Jewish people. They haven't interacted with anybody forget the outside world. So how does that work? The answer is it doesn't work. They have a really hard time, you know, coming back down to... Now, lahavdil, let me say lahavdil, elef alfei havdalot, to make a comparison, you spend a year immersed in Jewish learning, in Jewish experiences, and, you know, tefillah b'kavanah, you're here for a year and you're spending it and you're studying. I wouldn't compare, you know, seminary to a cave. I would probably compare it more to a Beit Midrash. But in a certain sense, I don't know if some of you feel like you're living in a cave, but in a certain sense, you're in a very, you know, you thought you lived in a bubble before. You're in a certain kind of protected environment, Jewishly protected environment. And the minute you leave that environment, you know, you start seeing the trucks with, you know, the holiday trees that I saw when I was in New York last week. So,
in a minute,
no, the lights and all that. There's a lot of wonder to it. There's no question about it. But you're like thrown back in, and you're sort of like, wow, I was like up here. You feel so inspired and so spiritually charged and filled with knowledge and filled with Torah and filled with, you know, all these ideas and all these kind of beautiful things that you hear from all of your teachers and all of your experiences that you've had. And then all of a sudden you're like hit with reality in the face. You're like, this is, you know, this doesn't work, right? And some people get very upset, and some people get very worked up, and some people get very frustrated. You know, why am I back in Israel? And as soon as you can, get back on the plane and come back and visit, or come back and study here. And multiply that by, you know, infinite. That was what Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was experiencing with his son. So comes Eliyahu HaNavi. By the way, what is Eliyahu HaNavi's role in the story? Why does he even show up? What does that mean? How do we understand that? Okay, so that also has to be understood. Somebody has to come and tell them. That would be the simple answer, but like, because nobody knew they were there, right? So somebody has to come and tell them. So Eliyahu HaNavi, he's always the one who gets picked for these jobs. He comes, he says, who's going to tell? And he doesn't even actually talk to them. He just kind of yells out at the entrance of the cave. He says, who's going to tell Shimon Bar Yochai that the emperor has died and you can leave the cave? Let's read the next part of the story. We probably won't have enough time even to get to the end, but we'll get through as much as we can. Who wants to pick up from where we are? Go ahead. Thank you. Middle of the page on the second page.
From they emerged?
Yep.
They emerged from the cave and saw people who were bowing and sowing.
Sowing, yeah.
Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai said, these people abandon internal life of Torah study and engage in temporal life for their own sustenance. The Gemara relates that every place that Rabbi Shimon and his son Rabbi Elazar directed their eyes was immediately burned. The divine voice emerged and said to them, did you emerge from the cave in order to destroy my world? Return to your cave. They again went and sat there for 12 months. They said, the judgment of the wicked in Gehenna lasts for 12 months. Surely their sin was atoned in that time. The divine voice emerged and said to them, emerge from your cave. They emerged. Everywhere that Rabbi Elazar would strike, Rabbi Shimon would heal. Rabbi Shimon said to Rabbi Elazar, my son, you and I suffice for the entire world, as the two of us are engaged in the proper study of Torah.
Okay, so was our prediction right? They come back into the world. What do they see? People go to work here. People go to school. People get an education. People are planting. They're doing technology. They're building. They're innovating. And they can't handle it. They can't handle it. They just can't reintegrate. They can't get back into the world. They can't get back into society. And everywhere they look, whether it's by choice or by force, it's sort of hard to actually figure out what it is. Like, is it just, it's an impulse? Like, they can't see people around them doing anything but, you know, living a spiritual life of tefillah and Torah learning. They just start destroying everything that's around them. And again, this is a metaphor, they're physically doing it. Ultimately, God says, you guys don't fit in. It's just not working. You're going to destroy the whole world this way. You have to go back in the cave. Now, what does this mean? What does this mean that they're not allowed to be in the world? They have to go back in the cave. What does that mean? How do you understand that?
That they have to, I don't know if it's right.
What are you saying?
Like relating it to like now, kind of like they have to learn how to be a Jew in the real world.
They have to learn how to be a Jew in the world, or at the very least, they have to be tolerant to people who live that kind of life.
How does being in the cave for longer help them with that?
Okay, that's also an interesting question. So somehow, they get the message that they need to go back, relearn, or refocus their attention, and figure out a way to either change their whole lifestyle, their own schedule, or at the very least, figure out a way how to live and let live, as we say. We'll do our thing, they'll do their thing, we won't bother them, they won't bother us. And you know what? What do they say at the end of that paragraph? Amar lo b'ni, dai lo olam ani v'ata. Right? You and I suffice in Torah. Meaning, it's okay. They're like wasting their time. They're going to work. You and me, Rabbi Shimon and his son, Rabbi Elazar, we'll continue learning our Torah. We'll continue living our spiritual life. And the whole world will survive based on our learning. Wow. And then not coming from a place of arrogance. Coming from a place of feeling that this is the true idealistic ideal for life. To just be in constant connection with Hashem, spirituality, Torah learning, tefillah. And they're living a mistaken life. Until something happens. Let's read this last part and then we'll sort of raise a few questions and we'll wrap up for the day. So the bottom paragraph. So what happens? They come out of the cave. Everywhere, and by the way, Rabbi Elazar seems to not have been rehabilitated. Rabbi Shimon does seem, or he's, at least he's controlling himself. Rabbi Elazar is still destroying. Rabbi Shimon has to heal. And then Rabbi Shimon says to his son, you know what, Rabbi Elazar, my son, Elazar, like, it's okay. They're going to do their thing. We're not going to actually change them. We're going to do our thing, and the world will continue as it is, and we'll do our best. So let's read this together. Bahadei panya demalei shabta, it was Erev Shabbat. They come out of the cave. They're walking the streets. It's Erev Shabbat. Chazu hahu sabada v'naki trei medane asa v'rai ben ashmashot. They see an old man running with two hadasim, two myrtle branches just before Shabbat. I saw one of the commentaries said he was bringing flowers home for Shabbat to his wife. Nice, right? Amar lei says to them, "Hani lamalacha, what are you doing with these?" So he said, "Amar lei kavod Shabbat, I bring them home to make my house beautiful for Shabbat." So he says, "Why do you need two? V'tizki lacha b'chad. Why do you need two branches?" He says, "Chad keneged zachor, chad keneged." Shamor. One is for Zachor, which is one of the mitzvot of Shabbat, to remember the day of Shabbat, that Hashem created the world, etc. And one is Keneged Shamor, all of the mitzvot, the negative, the 39 malachot that we protect ourselves from not performing creative activity on Shabbat. So Rabbi Shimon turns to his son, he says, Amar Le Lebrei, Chazei Kama Chavivin Mitzvot Yisrael. See how beloved the mitzvot are to the Jewish people, and at that moment, Yativ Datayhu, his mind was put at ease. He was altered. He was changed. He was they together. They were at peace with the fact that people were not doing everything that they were expecting of society. They had the standard that they were living, and they came down to the world, and not everybody was living by that standard. Okay. So let's pause here. I just want to turn to the last page. If you look on the last page, we're just going to go over these questions just so we have a wrap-up for everything. It's a bit confusing. Okay, so it's the fourth page. Should have got pushed to the fifth page. So this story is split into three parts. We just covered the beginning and the middle. I just want to go over the questions. We'll leave them as questions. I'll let you think about it, and then we'll come back to this story, not next week, but in 2 weeks. So the beginning, so here are the questions that I put. Some of them I've already mentioned. In the three-way argument, right at the beginning, who comes out as the winner? Or you can say who is right, or are they all right? Are they all legitimate perspectives? I would even say, I would add, I have it here, how can silence be considered an opinion? We spoke about a little bit. What about Yehuda, son of converts? He's the one who caused this whole Rabbi Shimon to have to run away. Is he at fault? Did he do something bad, or did he do something good? Maybe we would never, have the Zohar if he never would have told on them, then they never would have gone into the cave. Is there a place for Rabbi Shimon's idealism? You can call it extremism, call it what you want to call it. Is there a place for it in the Jewish life, Jewish lifestyle, Jewish living, Jewish community? Does it exist today? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Are people who sit and learn Torah all day, are they embodying that, or are they already not really on the level of Rabbi Shimon because they're, you know, they have smartphones and they you know, they live in the world also, and some of them eventually go on to work or go on to school if that happens, in depending on the community. And what's behind these opinions? We haven't even really got to the point of who is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and why is he saying this, and what's his background, what's his life about him? Maybe something happened in his life that caused him to say this, and Rabbi Yehuda, on the other hand, who has a sort of positive view of what the Romans gave. That's the beginning. The middle, again, some of the symbols that we spoke about, you know, the things that he ate, the clothing, the sand, all these different, what are all these symbols, what are all these things about? What changes, what change happens? That question was raised here. What actually happens during that 1 year in between? 12 years one way, and then 1 year everything's just, you know, corrected? Or what actually happens? What are they talking about? What are they thinking about? And how is the middle story connected to the first part of the story? We know chronologically he had to run away. But how does the debate about, you know, Rabbi Shimon being so against what the Romans have brought into the world, what does that have to do with him hiding in the cave? Is there a connection between those? So these are all interesting questions that I want to look at, not today because we don't have time, but we will look at them when we return. Everybody have a great rest of the day.